The second that Francis was inaugurated, the four aging Team Francis cardinals, and many more besides, set about machinating for the aggressive liberalisation of the church, for which pew-sitting Catholics have shown absolutely no enthusiasm at all. In fact, liberalising Christianity until it's basically indistinguishable from secular society is one of the things that's responsible for declining church attendance. And what's more, everyone knows this. Francis has even started to echo trendy critiques of the church in his pronouncements on gay marriage and abortion. He's blessed lesbian authors of books about the virtues of gay parenting, despite mountains of evidence that children raised by lesbians suffer damaging psychological consequences and are much more likely to witness domestic violence while their children are at home. He's cracked jokes about Catholic women breeding like rabbits, and perhaps his most cravenly attention-seeking stunt was washing the feet of Muslim migrants, insisting that we are all children of the same God. Ugh. If I ever hear another bishop claiming that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, I'm going to vomit. We do not. We categorically do not. This is nonsense. It is Islamic PR. Claiming Allah is the same as the Christian God, just worshipped in a different way, is a lie. It's a setup so Muslims can describe Islam as the perfected version of Christianity and refer to reverts instead of converts. Left-wingers in the West take their word for it and say Jews, Christians, and Muslims are all people of the book. But we aren't. Allah is an irrational, capricious tyrant who can make 2 + 2 = 5 at a moment's notice. He's not the source of love and rationality described in the Bible. He's not the God that Catholics worship. Muslims do not believe in the Trinity, and they deny the divinity of Christ. There's really no room for manoeuvre here at all. Have the doormats we call our spiritual leaders any idea how enthused the faithful would be to see them put Catholics first for once by telling the truth about this enduring but completely false claim? Most disturbingly for Catholics and most significantly for the future, Francis has sent signals that he wants divorced and remarried couples to receive communion. It's yet another embrace of moral relativism. The Pope's defenders in the media describe this as meeting people where they are. Theodore McCarrick, of course, boasted in a speech in Idaho in 2014 of the assistance he'd provided Pope Francis with this effort. But watering down the rules about who can receive communion is the first step to tossing out centuries of Catholic moral teaching, with the end goal, presumably, of abolishing the charge of adultery altogether. While ordinary Catholics crave moral guidance, and his priests desperately need a new, rigorous level of oversight, the Pope is giving speeches that describe sex as not a taboo but rather a gift from God, the clear implication of which to the casual listener, in line with his other recent statements, is that the Church should just chill out about matters of sexual identity and sexual behaviour. Social justice warriors from other fields know this playbook pretty well. First, a minor change is slipped in under the rubric of guidance, terms of service or community guidelines. Critics are asked, what's the big deal? We're just making sure everyone's happy and safe. Then the change starts to be sort of enforced, and then finally it becomes required. And when it's accepted as settled, further concessions are demanded or slipped into new versions of the rulebook. This is how American universities fell, not through revolution, but with 1,000 tiny concessions to progressive entreaties, all of them packaged in the language of forgiveness, tolerance, and love. Fast forward a generation or two, and everything the organization once stood for is essentially gone. All that remains is a vast, self-serving bureaucracy operated for the benefit of a clique of morally reprehensible people. Like their progressive equivalents elsewhere, it seems Team Francis would rather rule unchallenged over a diminished and disgraced institution than wield influence in a strong, politically diverse church that reflects the concerns and priorities of ordinary Catholics, and within which they might have to, shock horror, jostle for power with conservatives. But the pursuit of influence, power, and prestige at all costs, lashed to a superficial commitment to left-wing social causes and a true commitment to left-wing economic causes, has led to moral horror. Ruthless, opportunistic leaders commanding squadrons of bishops who believe that ushering in a Soros fever dream of open borders and soak-the-rich tax regimes is a higher priority than the immortal souls of their flock. I'm exaggerating, but not by very much. Team Francis has the same brazen, shameless, contemptuous attitude, the holier-than-thou demeanour and the mind-blowing lack of perspective as the social justice warriors were familiar with from social media. Take Francis's most loyal lieutenant in the United States, Blaise Cupich, a cardinal who defended the Pope's refusal to comment on the Vergano letter, and I'm not making this up, with the following words. He said, "The Pope has a bigger agenda. He's got to get on with other things, talking about the environment and protecting migrants." This is the sort of hot air that fills Catholic sermons in the West today, and it leaks down from the top. Not a lot of talk about sin, unless it's Donald Trump's, but rather a lot about environmentalism, globalism, socialism and social justice. Don't be surprised if the next time your priest takes to the ambo, he has more to say about white supremacy than salvation. So absent is God from the modern church that satire of the right-on preoccupations of Catholic priests has become prophetic and therefore impossible. In August 2018, the Babylon Bee, which is a satire website, published the headline, "Pope says he will address sex abuse scandal once he's finished talking about climate change." But it was a mere 2 months before Cupich provided something even better in real life. Mirabile dictu, the social justice tendency in the College of Cardinals, is concentrated among its most elderly members, who've been playing quite a long game to get one of their own on the throne, which at least offers us a little hope for the future. O'Connor's generation will be dead soon, taking their emetic 1970s politics and dress sense with them. The 70s truly were a kidney stone of a decade, as Gary Trudeau once quipped, and the church needs to rid herself of the products of that sorry decade as quickly as possible. A few days after dismissing the Vergano letter as a distraction from hand-wringing about migrants, and even when the dreadful implications of the letter were becoming clear, Cupich told a group of seminarians, "I feel very much at peace at this moment. I'm sleeping okay." If you're getting the impression that these guys can't possibly be real, that their public statements are just too wildly tone-deaf to be authentic, that they must be fictional villains, well, you're not alone. Even Catholics are getting sick of it all, musing aloud that Francis, in the words of one reporter, is an exceedingly uncertain trumpet. The author of that phrase, Jeff Myrus, is the founder of CatholicCulture.org, and he characterizes Francis's effect on the church like this. A hard-won Catholic renewal is being dismissed in favor of focusing on those few Christian values which the world is still willing to tolerate. For the past 50 years, this has been a recipe for Catholic laxity and disintegration. It has also hastened the ascendancy of a dominant secular culture which relegates Catholics and other sincere Christians to a second-class status, and that's putting it mildly. Well, he's right about that. What none of us knew at the time Ross Douthat was writing his Atlantic story, warning of a brewing schism in Catholicism, was that Francis would indeed come close to breaking the church. But it wouldn't be over politics, at least not directly. Instead, thanks to his inexcusable decision-making when rehabilitating political allies who have appalling abuse records, even going so far as to overturn the decisions of Benedict XVI to reinstate sex offenders and child abusers, Francis has distinguished himself, not as the reforming moderate of the media's imagination, or the progressive hero of Ross Douthat's, but instead a grubby, corrupt friend to any left-wing cardinal who buggers 11-year-olds but can be relied upon to do the Pope's bidding. The Church must now take a proactive stand against abuse as part of a wider and more fundamental series of reforms. One idea, suggested by Matthew Schmitz, is for the Church to push for new laws, making it a civil crime for clergy to abuse those over the age of 18 in addition to minors. Schmitz is right that taking the initiative and pushing for these laws in American states that don't have them would not only be properly penitential, but it might also help restore the Church's stained reputation. It's the sort of proactive move that can impress people and change their minds. The abuse of adults has been scrupulously ignored by Francis and the entire American church, with vulnerable adults only very recently added to the list of victims whose abuse even warrants punishment. That term, by the way, vulnerable adults, only refers to adults with handicaps, mental and otherwise, so it wouldn't include the seminarians that Uncle Ted McCarrick preyed upon. Sometimes clergy engage in consensual sex with one another, but as part of the church's necessary renewal, leaders should root this out almost as enthusiastically as they do the abuse of teenagers. But is Francis the right man to lead such a reform, tainted as he is by scandal and by his close alliance with Uncle Ted? Although Benedict XVI, as Pope Emeritus, has become a symbol of the conservative resistance to Team Francis, it's not for his pastoral or leadership abilities. Rod Dreyer, Writing in the American Conservative reminds us of a 5th-century student from Rome who would later become Saint Benedict, who, quote, withdrew from the city of Rome because it was so corrupt, and because he feared that if he stayed, he would lose his soul, end quote. His namesake, the Pope Emeritus, is said to have had precisely the same experience. Benedict XVI is a gifted theologian and a scholar, but not an especially talented leader of people. Friends say he realized he was powerless to resist the ingrained Vatican bureaucracy and especially the Lavender Mafia, and that he was not well suited to fighting the filth he saw infecting the church from root to branch. In more recent private letters, Benedict seems to express consternation at the present situation and regret that his name is even mentioned, and even by his supporters. He appears to want to disappear entirely, so it isn't clear who might lead a purge of the corrupt old order. But we need someone. Our own Donald Trump, perhaps, to follow the failure of the maverick Francis. He must be somewhere. Probably not in the priesthood. Fortunately, for now, the American laity is robust and independently minded. It's tired of excuses and ready for new leadership, even if that's leadership further down the food chain. Like, say, parish priests who adopt more of a get-on-with-it-and-apologise-later approach than has traditionally been considered the Catholic way. And those priests further down the food chain who recognise that bishops have squandered their moral authority and that parishioners have basically had it with a church hierarchy. They just want to get back to worshipping God properly, without all the left-wing moralising, the cover-ups, the hypocrisy, their rainbow flag chasubles and crappy acoustic guitar music. Books condemning Francis are now being published at a quite remarkable rate. And there are also feisty online publications springing up, like Church Militant, a website scrappy enough to alienate the snobs and doctrinally rigorous enough to be intimidating, both check marks in my book. Its critics call Church Militant the Catholic Breitbart, which I think they mean as an insult. Francis can't eradicate the problem because he's part of it. Instead, he continues to double down on the mistakes that created a lack of accountability in the church in the first place. The Pope continues to strengthen the executive authority of the Rome-controlled Synod of Bishops at the expense of good bishops who will be bullied into accepting the latest nuttery from Team Francis. Archbishop Chaput has publicly released a scathing critique of the Synod's latest working document, which provides a basis for discussions the next time the Synod meets. Thankfully, there are some hero priests still in the church, and I can't pretend I didn't cheer when I read that a priest in Chicago had defied his local bishop and burned a gay rainbow flag that had been displayed in his church. He said it was an exorcism ceremony. It wasn't any ordinary pride flag, of course, but a flag that blended the cross with the rainbow, a symbol, say parishioners, that Father Paul Kalchick's parish had been earmarked as the new gay-friendly Chicago parish. Notorious Father Daniel Montalbano's previous church, St. Sebastian, home to gay masses, had burnt down. Montalbano, it's reported, was close friends with Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, who presided over a mass with a rainbow flag draped over the crucifix. The latter died at the age of 50. He was found dead in a rectory bedroom in which he held gay sex parties. Bernardin's body was discovered naked and hooked up to what journalists are intriguingly calling a sex machine. No idea what exactly it was, but this was later covered up by church officials. Kalchick, who was himself a victim of clerical sexual abuse, our hero priest, was protesting about the political statement the pride flag was making, especially in light of the gay sex scandal engulfing the church and engulfing his own diocese. Kalchick is the face of heroism in today's church because he's one of the few priests prepared to stand up to the Lavender Mafia. What they did to him in response, in revenge for his little stunt, beggars belief. And it's the reason that at the time of writing this and the time that I'm reading it to you in this studio, Father Kalchick has gone into hiding. His bishop, Archbishop Kupich, threatened him with forced psychiatric assessment and even hinted at his death. Cardinal Kupich threatened to have Kalchick evicted by police if he did not attend St. Luke, which is a treatment centre whose former CEO was convicted of embezzling $200,000 and spending the money on his gay lover. Kalchick had previously written a letter to Francis as a former victim, begging the Pope to act more decisively against abusive priests and those who shelter them, and speaking about Chicago's gay mafia. Perhaps that marked him out for punishment. The two priests dispatched to discipline and threaten Kalchick for offending gay sensibilities were both known to be implicated in the Chicago wrongdoing. Cardinal Kupich may have no time for doctrinal fidelity, but he's been coached for years in far-left transgender ideology by a social justice warrior called Alexandra Whitney, who says she pressured him to ditch Kelchik. There's now a petition circulating calling for Kupich to resign. As Father Dwight Longenecker, a popular Catholic blogger, puts it, so we have a priest who's been traumatized by gay sex abuse and who dissents from being steamrolled by the Rainbow Brigade, and the church's response is fire him, kick him out, send him to the loony bin, write him off, throw him under the bus, and if all that fails, call the police. Rod Dreyer has correctly called Kelchik a martyr. Dreyer also quotes an unnamed priest whose grimly fascinating letter is worth listening to in full. It's about the sort of malicious punishments that can be doled out to priests who step out of line with the politically correct consensus. Here's the letter in full. Quote, there's nothing that the laity can do to protect priests. Bishops have total authority over us. We can certainly walk away, we can leave, but Kelchik is a great example of what happens when a priest stands up to his bishop's agenda. He's probably done as a priest. He can submit to St. Luke's and get the evaluation, but St. Luke's has an alliance with the bishops as well. It's the bishops who pay the bill. When a priest goes there, the priest must sign a release for everything he discusses to be turned over to the bishop and the diocese. So how's he supposed to deal with any real psychological issues he might have, knowing that the data is going to be sent back to the bishop and put into files or even potentially released or used against him? The priest isn't free. It's a coercive environment rigged against priests, and the information can be used by bishops to continue to manipulate those priests for years. And it's all under the guise of, I just want Father X to be healthy. What they're really after is reconditioning priests to act within a particular safe metric to avoid bad publicity or cause problems. Sounds a bit Orwellian, doesn't it? Another side of this is that bishops have to hold liability insurance on their priests, and if the priests have some kind of HR problem or occupational problem in their parish, the insurance companies are demanding bishops send them to places like St. Luke's for a kind of reconditioning therapy that they don't need. Priests are not actually in any kind of need of psychological assistance, but for the diocese to continue to have coverage with liability insurance, the insurance company puts pressure on the bishop for them to demonstrate they've taken measures to lessen liability. A St. Luke's program of 6 months of incarceration and therapy with 5 years of outpatient programming is just such a program. All of this goes into the priest's file and is held against him the rest of his career to get trotted out any time he gets out of line. Notice none of this has anything to do with the abuse of children, perhaps some with moral failure or bad decisions, maybe decisions that would cause a layperson to lose their job. But in the priesthood, you get the shame of 6 months of incarceration in a lockdown facility and forced psychological treatment that even these facilities know you do not need. But they participate in the sham because it's big revenue and they're cashing in on the bishop's need to cover their liability. This is happening in large numbers throughout the country to priests. End quote. Just reflect on that for a second. You can expect to see a lot more extraordinary form masses quietly appearing across Catholic America as traditionalists get more of the sort of worship they want, whether their bishop likes it or not. The laity in the United States is a great deal more God-fearing than its clergy, more respectful of historical tradition, and less afraid than ever to announce itself, despite smirking and ridicule from the liberal establishment. There are still a few rebellious, heroic junior priests, like Father Kelchik, eager to help them. And for the first time in living memory, the laity seems prepared to turn its back on the current pope, if that's what it takes to survive. Francis has been described by those in the know as a Peronist, which basically means he won't go out quietly. But if he won't resign, he can't be forced out, so his critics have no choice but to wait for him to keel over or be persuaded that he's no longer the best man for the job. Conservatives are sticklers for the rules, and this is a big one. You can't force a pope out. And there's no appetite for a coup, say those experts, because this would return the church to the bad old days of popes and anti-popes, during which there were competing claims of legitimacy from rival camps, each of whom said that their man was the real pope. That sort of chaos really would tear the church apart. Conservatives also worry that two popes resigning in a row would permanently change expectations of papal terms. Before Benedict, it had been 600 years since the Pope had resigned. But if Francis were to go early as well, there'd no longer be a presumption that new popes planned to die in office. Political opponents would then become incentivized to make popes as miserable as possible until they resigned. If cardinals know a pope can be pressured to give up his seat, pressure will be applied. This too could tear the church apart, forever diminishing the standing of the Bishop of Rome. The papacy would become just like any other sort of political appointment, subject to the same vulnerabilities and ugly clashes as any other sort of elected leadership. As the Weekly Standard terrifyingly prophesied, before you know it, you'd have polling data and opposition research. There are some quirky ideas floating around the blogosphere, such as whether Francis can be sued as a private individual for his role in covering up child abuse scandals. But there appears to be no appetite for any strategies that would imperil future papacies or further damage the office in any way. His staunchest critics are wondering, therefore, if Francis can simply be endured. Sitting out the reign of a lame duck pope might resemble what Bob Woodward says is going on in the Trump White House already. There's a guy sitting in the chair issuing orders, but it's essentially up to his subordinates to decide whether or not to follow them. Information coming to the big desk is strictly limited. Popes do eventually die, but the church endures. Can the church, in its present condition, survive that kind of entropy? Well, yes, but only if we embrace a paradoxical and unexpected route. A religious revival and a call to arms for new converts and the defagging of the Bride of Christ. Now is the time to convert to Catholicism, not away from it. Not to save a few corrupt old queers in purple robes and St. Peter's, but because we recognize the nature of the Church, the truth of its foundation, sacraments, saints, and the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. The Lavender Mafia may control the papacy and even the Holy City for now, but their reign will not last forever. We can't leave it up to the remaining sound bishops to wrest back power from these amoral careerists who have sheltered pederasts and pedophiles for decades. It's time for ordinary Catholics to stand on their hind legs and roar by withholding donations to organizations and agencies that do not do good Catholic work and by loudly insistently demanding the resignations of anyone tainted by the present scandal and any future similar scandal, no matter how deeply or painfully that may cut into the College of Cardinals, and with no regard paid to the politics of those involved. We need more ex-cardinals. We embark upon this journey because no other future is conceivable, and because we know that only with legions of fresh blood can we effect the coming purge of corrupt cardinals and bishops, and start our beloved church on the path to redemption. Scrubbing the effeminate, the weak, the dishonest, the disreputable, the duplicitous, and the malevolent from the church will make way for the restoration we really need, a restoration of manhood and a strong Catholicism that recognizes the equal but different contributions of men and women and embodies the best of both of them. Manliness is what the church is lacking. Manliness is a willingness to expose yourself to enemy fire, whether it comes from critics on social media, gunfire on the battlefield, or the horrors of the passion. It's the impulse opposite to the snivelling cowardice of the petty palace intriguer. As Rodrias says, anyone who fails to teach young men the masculine God of Scripture leaves those young men vulnerable to the false gods of race and ideology, or, and Dreyer doesn't phrase it like this, obviously, leaves them to turn into low-testosterone soy boys blogging about microaggressions for BuzzFeed. Whether or not you wear a uniform, you can still be manly and courageous in defense of family, church, country, and civilization. When Pope Francis puts on his uniform in the morning, for whom is he fighting? There's a phrase from Chesterton that I like. It's become something like my personal motto, and it's laughter and war. That works well for a mischievous culture warrior like me, but the full passage from Heretics is worth some reflection in the context of a church that's lost all manhood and absorbed a critical mass of morally depraved and psychologically defective clergymen who entered the service of a church seeking emoluments and advantages, as one writer has put it, unrelated to her spiritual mission, in addition to leaders constitutionally unsuited to the exercise of the virtues of truthfulness and fortitude. And here's Chesterton. The Salvation Army's methods are the methods of all intense and hearty religions. They are popular, like all religion, military, like all religion, public and sensational, like all religion. They are not reverent any more than Roman Catholics are reverent, for reverence, in the sad and delicate meaning of the term reverence, is a thing only possible to infidels. That beautiful twilight you will find in Euripides, in Renan, in Matthew Arnold, but in Men Who Believe you will not find it. You will only find laughter and war. A man cannot pay that kind of reverence to truth, solid as marble. They can only be reverent towards a beautiful lie. And the Salvation Army, though their voice is broken out in a mean environment and in an ugly shape, are really the old voice of glad and angry faith, hot as the riots of Dionysus, wild as the gargoyles of Catholicism, not to be mistaken for a philosophy. Good mental hygiene requires us to have the proper natural response to things, whether it's good or bad. It's right and proper to hate hateful things, and we shouldn't abandon outrage to the emotionally damaged 20-somethings on Twitter. The political left knows this, but it wants to deny its enemies the same weaponry it has, which is why leftist activists are, at once, violent, hysterical, perpetually outraged crybabies, but they nonetheless require delicate handling so they don't fall apart entirely. We should respond appropriately to such base manipulations with laughter and war. We should refuse to play along. We should fight fire with hellfire. Our national life is ended, write Lunn and Lean in their Cult of Softness, as soon as it has lost the power of noble anger. When it paints over and apologizes for its pitiful criminalities, dares not to decide practically between good and evil, and can neither honor the one nor smite the other, but sneers at the good as if it were hidden evil, and consoles the evil with pious sympathy, the end is come. Leon Podal says that the ideology of masculinity has replaced Christianity as the true religion of men. He's right. What's needed now, then, is a fusion of the two. Spiritual fatherhood, the deepest masculinity, is the only way out of the church's present crisis. We need to get the men back. Sometimes that's going to mean being angry. What's so black and white to most dads and to most moms is somehow inexplicably complicated for some prelates, says Podals. Good spiritual dads not only don't abuse their children, but become ferocious in protecting their children from those who try. They also, justly, become white-hot furious whenever anyone hurts their kids or looks the other way. Too many priests in the modern Catholic Church keep strength and masculinity hidden, or apologize for it, or outright demonize it, because they have such a complex relationship with their own. And too many priests have no sense of moral responsibility for their charges. Men like Archbishop Chaput, whose lecture on Why Men Matter gave me hope that at least some priests still get it, well, they're in short supply. It's not enough just to be nice. True faith requires a lot more of us than politeness, artifice, and good manners. Too often, we're subjected to mawkish bullshit about acid rain or guns from weak duds like American Magazine's James Martin, who never met a left-wing cause he didn't like, especially if it somehow undermined core church teachings and provided an opportunity to wallow in helplessness and self-pity. Sometimes a man, a real man, must take a stand, and he must do so angrily and righteously. Pope Francis does not understand righteous anger, or else he would not have rehabilitated Theodore McCarrick. Perhaps that means he cannot lead the church and its wild gargoyles. As the Reverend Jerry J. Pekorsky puts it, the sense of abandonment by the Holy Father is palpable. The most strident but provocatively honest comment I received was from a pastor serving in a diocese apart from mine. The Holy Father, that priest said, has left us orphans. He prefers to protect buddies rather than his bride, the church, in direct opposition to Christ laying down his life for the church. Francis is the ultimate symbol of the crisis of masculinity in the West. He is neither father nor husband. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, had conservatives frothing at the mouth when he suggested that a few acts of terrorism now and again were basically part and parcel of living in a big cosmopolitan city. I don't think he meant to make excuses for the terrorist actions, though, since he's a man who merrily attends gender-segregated events to suck up to Muslims with regressive social attitudes, who knows? What I think he was getting at, though, was that these occasional horrors were a price worth paying for multiculturalism. I don't agree, obviously, either that the horrors are occasional, or that such mindless multiculturalism is worth a damn thing. Khan is offering multiculturalism as a form of redemption, appeasement to the gods of diversity for colonial sins past. What I offer in this book comes with a lot less risk and much higher reward. Because although Kahn's premises are faulty, his reasoning is sound. The world is messy and imperfect. The church is messy and imperfect. Inside and outside of the Christian, things are complicated. And as the novelist Flannery O'Connor wrote to a Protestant friend who was considering the leap to Rome but was daunted by the church's surface flaws, quote, "It's easy for a child to pick out the faults in a sermon on his way home from church every Sunday. It's impossible to find out the hidden love that makes a man. In spite of his intellectual limitations, his neuroticism, his own lack of strength, give up his life to the service of God's people, however bumblingly he may go about it. Because you don't serve God by saying the church is ineffective. I'll have none of it. Your pain at its lack of effectiveness is a sign of your nearness to God. We help overcome this lack of effectiveness simply by suffering on account of it. To expect too much is to have a sentimental way of life, and this is a softness that ends in bitterness. Charity is hard, and it endures." End quote. No one, except for children and Democrat voters, believe that you can save everyone. There are always ugly moral compromises to be made, and so it is with the Catholic Church. The charges laid against her are vast, and they are grave, and most of them are probably true. The Church is at least guilty enough to warrant wholesale reform. But we would be insane to throw out the very basis of our civilization, welcoming in all manner of horrors, from Islam to the feminists of the progressive left, to occupy her place just because the church's ministers have gone astray. If you're a Catholic devastated by what's happened to the church in this summer of shame, take heart. Because the church has survived, as one writer tells us, 5 apocalypses already, including the Arian and Albigensian heresies, Voltaire and Darwin. As Chesterton wrote in a book that was crucial to C.S. Lewis's conversion, "Christianity has died many times and risen again, for it had a God who knew the way out of the grave." As Father Rutler once observed, the real danger to society is not merely a lack of virtue, it's a lack of heroism. There's a generation of young men without proper moorings who could be moulded into soldiers of Christ if only the church would try. They could be filled with that glad and angry faith by the right spiritual leader. To save the West, we have to bring these men back to the church. If these men lose their bond to the church, then the secular world, which will always be dominated by men, also loses its connection to the church and to her truths. Pope Francis does not speak to any of these young men whose faith is kept alive in spite of his guidance, not because of it. Without discipline and leadership, my generation and the one after it could easily topple into barbarism. Look to the East and consider the virility and malevolence of Islam. That's why a clerical purge is needed now. Not because the crimes and the cover-ups are so awful, although they are, and not because gays can't ever be good priests, but because the faithful need much, much better generals to survive the war that's coming. Appendix. What have the Romans ever done for us? This is a reading list. Chesterton held that aside from flowers at Easter and sausages at Christmas, everything else in the modern world is of Christian origin. Even everything that seems the most anti-Christian. The French Revolution is of Christian origin. The newspaper is of Christian origin. The anarchists are of Christian origin. Physical science is of Christian origin. The attack on Christianity is of Christian origin. There's one thing, he says, and one thing only in existence at the present day, which can in any sense accurately be said to be of pagan origin, and that is Christianity. As ever, he was right. The answer to the question, what good things about Western civilization came from the church, is all of them. It's beyond the scope of this book, and it's beyond the scope of 100 books, in fact, to give a full account of how indebted we are to Christianity for everything we hold dear. But this chapter will provide some hints and a short reading list for those of you still not convinced that the Catholic Church is worth preserving. Some of what follows will surprise you. Decades of liberal indoctrination in college has planted dozens of ahistorical myths and falsehoods about the West into popular consciousness, especially the intellectual debt we supposedly owe to Islam. Each of the examples I provide here gives a sense of the scope and depth and richness of the Western Christian tradition, and what we could lose if we say farewell to the Catholic Church. Indeed, what we're already losing is an enfeebled church and an emasculated West slide into degenerate secularism and progressivism. First of all, what we now know as the West is merely what was left over following the Muslim conquest of Christendom, which is why, according to historian Raymond Ibrahim, Europe's self-identity never revolved around ethnicity or language, but rather religion. Europe was the last and most redoubtable bastion of Christendom to be conquered by Islam, he says. Hence the meme popularized by, well, by me, of reclaiming Constantinople. In other words, Western identity is a product of Islamic aggression, defined by its Christianity. That's worth repeating. Christianity defines the West, and not race, not geography, not gender, or anything else the modern academy is preoccupied with. In what follows, I'll try to give as brief an account as possible of what makes the West so sensational and so fabulous, and why we have God to thank for all of it. First off, our very idea of ourselves as distinct individuals is a product of Christianity. We're human beings recognized as ensouled, regardless of skin color, gender, or social class, because we have a relationship with the Almighty and because we're created in His image. Everything in the Western legal system depends on this definition of the individual as indivisible and uniquely worthy. It's the basis of equality before the law. Nothing in pagan pre-medieval traditions speaks to equal status before God, regardless of ethnicity or sex. And Christianity does not recognize the slave morality of Nietzsche, or even Aristotle's belief that slavery was natural for some people. Just as Christianity granted dignity to the lowest, it also humbled the mighty. King David was answerable to God for his sins, bound by the law, just like everyone else. A recent book on this subject is called Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism. Although the Bible accepts slavery as a fact of life, which at the time it was, slavery often ends in cultures that convert to Christianity. And in the Christian world, it is Christians arguing with other Christians that brings an end to the practice. Slavery is still practiced throughout the world, especially in Islamic countries, but no longer exists in Christian nations. Only more religion can give us less modern slavery. Rodney Stark, who's written many excellent and robust defenses of Christianity, specifically includes the end of slavery as one of the great accomplishments of Christianity in his book For the Glory of God. And Thomas Sowell makes a similar argument in Black Rednecks and White Liberals. A daft but persistent myth about Western civilization is that Christianity is bellicose. Modern secularists love to imagine that without the specter of religion, life would be bliss. There would be no war, no death, no famine, and we'd all get to hold hands and dance in a circle around Stonehenge, giving praise to life-giving Mother Gaia before tearing our clothes off and getting down to some pansexual opium orgy action. But real paganism was pretty bloody cruel, and Christians generally eschewed its worst excesses, such as gladiatorial combats. Christianity directly brought about the decline in violence that Steven Pinker wrongly attributes to the Enlightenment. It did so as a response to the cruelty of paganism. Moral barbarisms such as racism and the treatment of women and gays in the Islamic world are often reflexively described as medieval, but they're actually pre-medieval. This does a horrible disservice to the actual Middle Ages, which were characterized by a remarkable insensitivity to tribalism and race, thanks, of course, to the rise of Christianity. Religion's not a catch-all explanation for endemic violence. That's a left-wing myth. Only certain religions are, one of them in particular. The Crusades were considered by knights to be acts of penance. They weren't embarked upon for houris. The Crusades were a defensive set of wars based not on skin colour but on religion. And to those who say, well, can't we get rid of the religion to get rid of the wars? Nice try. History shows us that human beings would, and do, simply go to town on one another over something else. Isn't it better that we fight over the core values of our faith and civilization than over something as arbitrary as skin colour? Isn't it more important to fight over culture than colour? The left has been trying to conflate Western with white for decades, to scare conservatives off from defending their civilization too forcefully, lest they produce the dreaded career-destroying allegation of racism. None of this is to say that Christianity embraces or encourages violence. Unlike Islam, it doesn't. While Muslims are actively encouraged into holy war by their faith, Christians struggle endlessly to figure out how war is not inevitably sinful. As Raymond Ibrahim demonstrates in the book I quoted from earlier, it's called Sword and Scimitar. There is an enormous difference. For Augustine, a war was only just if it was declared by a legitimate authority, either a public authority or God, if it was defensive or fought to recover stolen possessions, if it was necessary, and if it was fought from a place of love. In the 10th and 11th centuries, Christians further restricted the concept of just war by marking non-combatants as off-limits. What was appropriate in warfare and all the noble traditions that eventually became the Geneva Convention and other similar international agreements about the proper conduct of war emerge from this line of reasoning. Most of what we cherish about the modern world, in fact, has its roots in the Middle Ages. The Enlightenment, on the other hand, provided us, well, with the scientific racism, for one thing, that fueled the Third Reich, and the hubris that led to most of the world's unique horrors, such as the post-Christian awfulness of communism. David Bentley Hart's Atheist Delusions provides a neat summary of the positive effects of Christianity on the old world. Islam is an inherently violent creed, and it was founded on jihad. Only Christianity has faced down paganism and won, and only Christianity truly preaches peace. Speaking of things that Steven Pinker gets wrong, we should debunk this left-wing myth that religion is at odds with science. It isn't. Christianity grounds the study of the natural world in reason, as Benedict XVI's brilliant 2006 Regensburg lecture on faith, reason, and the university explained. Benedict showed us it was Christianity, not Islam, that fostered scientific thinking, and that the scientific ethos is the will to be obedient to the truth, and as such it embodies an attitude which belongs to the essential decisions of the Christian spirit. Early scientists wanted to explore the world around them and find out how it worked, because it was a magnificent and a mysterious gift from God. For an account of how we ended up believing that science and religion were at loggerheads, there is a long and complex, brilliant book, Brad Gregory's The Unintended Reformation, How a Religious Revolution Secularized Society. For a less intimidating summary, my friend Rachel Fulton Brown at the University of Chicago has you covered on her blog, Fencing Bear at Prayer, where she summarizes some of the arguments in Brad Gregory's book. The needless schism between faith and reason has led us to an ugly place where our entire philosophical and political systems are rotting from within, absent their critical metaphysical undergirding. One thing Christianity invented, which modern life could do with more of, is respect for women, as expressed in chivalry and consensual marriage. As Professor Fulton Brown argues, chivalry arose out of the desire to serve the Virgin Mary as the bride described in the Song of Songs, which deals specifically with sexual love. Serving a woman civilizes and channels male aggression into protecting the weak, while also ennobling the woman, who's the object of a man's affections. It holds the woman to a particular set of standards, and that's why unshaven, foul-mouthed feminists hate old-fashioned etiquette so much. Both sexes, in this vision, have to make an effort, not just the men. Augustine wrote that he would never have recognized God's love were it not for the love and prayerfulness of his mother, Monica. But he was not under the modern delusion that men and women are just the same, aside from a few unfortunate social constructs. The Catholic Church invented consensual marriage because it was the first institution to insist that the woman also said, "I do." This strengthened the woman's position as a sacramental equal to her husband, and George Duby's classic account, The Knight, the Lady and the Priest, The Making of Modern Marriage in Medieval France, explains the history of this. As the writer Michael Walsh has put it, quote, "Christianity transformed women from chattel and helpless rape victims into human beings, a trick of cultural prestidigitation that Islam has not managed to accomplish in well over a millennium. Who may not have had the political rights of men, but who had the human rights of men. Where Christianity, through its liberation of women, forces men to improve themselves morally, imparting the virtue of self-restraint, Islam seeks to protect the weaker sex, men, from the stronger, and so allows them to beat and even murder the females in their orbits." End quote. Anthony Iselin has written that Christians insisted on co-ed baptisms because all were under one God, and that Jesus was seen by women before he was seen by his apostles. Romans cherished and revered their wives and shunned sexual practices that put them and their spouses at risk. The oracle at Delphi said, "Know thyself," but it was Christian monks reciting the Psalms who made self-examination and confession a spiritual discipline. Recitation of the Psalms was intended to produce the same emotions as the psalmist had had, especially those of contrition. Augustine of Hippo's Confessions is the best known example in literature of someone wrestling with his life of sin before conversion. Medieval Christians were even trained to examine themselves for sins, not only sexual, but those of the soul, and Ignatius Loyola examined his conscience long before Freud made a science of self-reflection. It's not just psychoanalysis that the church invented. Many of Christianity's woes find their etiology in its own virtues. Its embrace and elevation of the feminine has become an emasculated clerisy. Its social justice metastasized into modern progressivism. And the idea that one culture might recognize the value in another has become an unthinking modern obsession with multiculturalism. In 601 AD, Pope Gregory the Great told Abbot Melissus not to destroy the pagan temples he found in Anglo-Saxon England and instead consecrate them and adapt them for Christian worship. Christians have bent over backwards to understand other cultures and welcome them into their faith rather than cleansing the earth of any trace of prior religions, as Islamic fanatics regularly do, because the latter follow a totalitarian belief system that cannot tolerate the existence of outside authority. The root of this multicultural appreciation is, of course, Pentecost, when the people gathered in Jerusalem for a feast to hear the apostles speaking in their own native tongues. Like capitalism, Christianity has been resilient and adaptable because it values labor and creativity. George Gilder's Wealth and Poverty explains how the free market depends upon openness to the divine. Speaking of people who make things, Dorothy Sayers' Mind of the Maker reminds us that the central metaphor of Christianity is of God as a maker, one who labored to create the world, which Tolkien understood as a writer and explored in his Mythopoeia. Because we're made in the image and likeness of a maker, we too are called upon to make art. That's not to say that Christianity wants everyone to be a perfumed aesthete. Physical labor, though, is not looked down upon by Christians, as it is by Western elites today. Jesus spent his days working with wood, and Peter was a fisherman, which is about the most smelly and disgusting job around. Christianity has provided infinitely more pleasure than poison, especially when it comes to music and to the written word. It's an easier sell to people that art and music are compatible with faith and perhaps even spring out of it, since we've all had such uplifting experiences of both. But again, we must turn to Benedict for the full picture. His 2008 lecture to the Collège de Bernardin, and it was called Meeting with Representatives from the World of Culture, shows how music depends upon faith to succeed. Michael Walsh's The Fiery Angel, subtitle of that book is Art, Culture, Sex, Politics, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West, is another recent addition to the literature on this. It only glances at the medieval, but it does stop to explain how late medieval polyphony trained the West to think in multiple voices and to work towards an aesthetic experience that was satisfying emotionally and formally, uniting the passions and reason together. Islam, of course, has no such musical tradition and therefore lacks an awareness of temporality and the satisfaction of understanding emerging from storytelling. Aside from one truly noteworthy moment of sexual passion I enjoyed in late 2017, stepping inside St. Peter's Basilica in Rome was the most spiritually uplifting and remarkable experience of my life. Make sure you do it before you die. To understand how art, architecture, music, and literature fuse together in celebration of God, and they are indivisible from his creation. Novelists in the 18th and 19th centuries were masters at deploying quotidian details from daily life, reflecting how Christianity so often works, from the mundane to the transcendent. Augustine's ideals of God speaking in the humble style we call sermo humilis. Christian authors often address the simple and the everyday as a way of lifting the mind to understanding. The use of the imagination for the sake of empathy is an invention of Christian art, designed to recall Christ's humanity and to help us empathize with his suffering on the cross. This is the heart of medieval devotion. The effect of empathy on art was to elevate ordinary people into proper subjects for artistic exploration and to give them status as protagonists. An early example of this, of course, is Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, with its storytelling pilgrims from all walks of life. While the ancients had a rhetorical practice of taking on different characters, it was Christianity that added the desire to feel on behalf of another, and that's the innovation that made the majority of literature possible. The Canterbury Tales is one of the earliest examples in the English language of genuinely funny writing, the sort of thing you might laugh out loud reading in the library by accident, especially the more profane passages in the Miller's Tale, which have provided literature students joy for generations. And it's joy that Chesterton correctly identifies as the preeminently unique characteristic of Christianity. He is, as ever, worth quoting at length. Chesterton says, quote, "Joy, which was the small publicity of the pagan, is the gigantic secret of the Christian." And as I close this chaotic volume, I open again the strange small book from which all Christianity came, and I'm again haunted by a kind of confirmation. The tremendous figure which fills the Gospels towers in this respect, as in every other, above all the thinkers who ever thought themselves tall. His pathos was natural, almost casual. The Stoics, ancient and modern, were proud of concealing their tears, but he never concealed his tears. He showed them plainly on his open face at any daily sight, such as the far sight of his native city. Yet he concealed something. Solemn supermen and imperial diplomatists are proud of restraining their anger. He never restrained his anger. He flung furniture down the front steps of the temple and asked men how they expected to escape the damnation of hell. Yet he restrained something. I say it with reverence. There was in that shattering personality a thread which must be called shyness. There was something that he hid from all men when he went up a mountain to pray. There was something that he covered constantly by abrupt silence or impetuous isolation. There was some one thing that was too great for God to show us when he walked upon our earth, and I have sometimes fancied that it was his mirth. Elsewhere in his Heretics, Chesterton characterizes the joyful, unreasonable virtues that are Christian innovations, faith, hope, and charity, with their pagan antecedents. J.R.R. Tolkien wrote in letter 310 to Camilla Unwin that the purpose of life was to praise the Creator with hymns of joy. Laughter underpins the divine comedy of Christianity. Catholic Christians, medieval ones at least, are always about to burst into laughter or song. Their churches are adorned with mischievous, sexually explicit carvings. Christianity is never solemn for long, and never in the way that Islam and paganism are. My personal motto, laughter and war, borrowed from Chesterton, is rooted in this fact that Christianity's greatest gift to us is joy, and that without God, laughter is hollow and fleeting. Acknowledgements. I try not to hurt my friends and acquaintances, so I usually do not associate myself with them in public. But Professor Rachel Fulton Brown of the University of Chicago has offered many helpful suggestions, as did Scott Walter and Mark Bauerlein, and it would be wrong not to thank them. Chadwick Moore tells me when I've used a joke too often, or if it's not as funny as I think it is, which happens very often. And I'm grateful to David Bernstein at Bombardier Books for taking me on, which is fitting, since his imprint was founded because of me. In the mysterious communion of saints, observes Flannery O'Connor, there are lines that join the most diverse lives and which hold us fast in Christ. I'm indebted to the many conservative and Christian writers and scholars whose reporting and punditry provided such good raw material for this book. Now, finally, they know how enthusiastically I'm bringing up the rear. My thanks then to Leon Podels, Anthony Eastland, David French, Matthew Schmitz, Ross Duthat, Edward Penton, Michael Brendan Doughty, Sohrab Amari, Rod Dreyer, and of course, many others. Catholicism certainly makes for strange bedfellows, but then the Lord we worship never shunned whores, adulterers, or even tax collectors. Of course, if Jesus had lived to see the IRS or today's Republican Party, he might have thought differently. The end.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.